Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LeDuc, the producer of The Roundtable on WAMC. Each weekday morning, WAMC's president and CEO and political observer Alan Chartok and Roundtable host Joe Donahue are joined by various experts, journalists, educators, and commentators to discuss current events. On Roundtable panel, The Week in Review, we feature your favorite panelists discussing the most important issues of the week. On Wednesday, June 2nd, Joe and Alan were joined by investigative journalist and UAlbany adjunct professor Rosemary Armeo, Times Union columnist Chris Churchill, and dean of the College of Emergency Preparedness, Homeland and Cybersecurity at the University at Albany, Robert Griffin.
We will talk about voting protections at the Tulsa event yesterday. Of course, yesterday, the 100th anniversary of the Tulsa race massacre, which took place on May 31st and June 1st. 1921, Biden announced that his vice president, Kamala Harris, will lead a push for voting protections in response to states' recent ballot restrictions. He promised to, quote, these are fighting words, fight like heck.
Inspiring.
Let the record show. Rosemary just rolled her eyes. should have said hell. Against Republican efforts to restrict voting, using the anniversary of a racist massacre in Tulsa to respond to Democrats' growing anxiety that his low-key approach was threatening fair elections and their own electoral future. Biden announced that he was tapping Vice President Harris to marshal an effort against the increasing array of Republican-led state laws that restrict voting in various ways, a campaign Biden condemned as un-American. He said, quote, this sacred right is under assault with incredible intensity like I've never seen, adding that June should be a month of action on Capitol Hill and taking what appeared to be a shot at Democratic Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, suggesting that they often side with Republicans. So I will begin with you, Alan, and ask what you make of this. And also, just how much can the president do on this in putting Vice President Harris on the case of what actually are the possibilities?
Well, Joe, he's doing exactly the right thing. He's taking the gloves off. He's saying, enough, Mr. Nice Guy. We have a potential dictator here. I've been saying this for quite a while, and he's saying it now. He's talking about the potential death of democracy. And he's right, because this terrible ex-president of ours is all about doing what has been done in so many countries, taking over. And now talking about, you know, having his people say, you know, this is we gotta make a change here, and we gotta take over from Biden, and the real president is still out there. Well, this is terrifying. It is terrifying because it's been successful in other countries. I think it's about time that Biden did take off the gloves and make it clear that the death of democracy is what could come out of Trumpism.
Donald Trump said on Tuesday that he expects to be back in office by August. Bob Griffin.
Can you imagine?
Bob.
That August comment kind of blew me away, too. Although anytime Trump says something like that, usually there's some sort of court or legal issue that's coming down the pike that he's trying to get us not to look at. You know, Alan, I think you're spot on. And I think what the president also is doing is he's trying to do what presidents should do, and that's be the moral weather vane for the country. I wish he was a little bit stronger on it. I wish he would be more vocal about how bedrock voting rights are and easy access to voting is. I mean, it's fundamental to our country. And as I've thought about what's happening in the states, particularly looking at what's happening in places like Texas and Florida and Georgia, you start to see the seeds of an apartheid system here, where a very small minority is manipulating the rules and the laws in order to stay in power over a majority. And I do think this is a very dangerous time for this country and democracy. And I'm disgusted with the lack of voices from GOP about state rights and about the protection of voting and in the state of our democracy.
It is.
It's the installation of fascism. That's what it is. I mean, no less than that.
Rosemary.
Well, first of all, I have some concerns that he's turning Kamala Harris into Jared Kushner. She's already got immigration in the southern border, and now he's throwing this on her. She's great. I totally support her, but she's completely inexperienced in both these areas, and they're the two thorniest problems of the past two administrations. So I think that's completely unrealistic. If you mean by taking off the gloves that he's put another job in her assignment list and said heck in public, I don't see it. If I were he, I'd be talking a whole lot with Joe Manchin, who's the key to this. We need federal regulations. We need a federal law to undo what's happening in the state level, and that is very scary. And there are two ways to do it. One is to get rid of the filibuster, and Manchin is the key to that. And two is to barter with Manchin, who has actually a really good idea on voter rights, which is that we go back to the old rule, but instead of making 10 states, the southern states, the old Confederacy, liable to prove that you're being fair, you make all 50 states be fair. That would work. It would be really hard again for the Republicans to say they're against that, and there's a real possibility of making it work. That's what I'd be doing, not saying fighting words and saying, oh, yeah, Kamala's going to save us all. I don't believe it.
So, Rosemary, don't you think that he had to check with her before he gave her that assignment and that it's possible she even asked for it?
Don't you think Trump checked with Jared before he said, can you cure cancer and also fix the Middle East? And he wanted the assignment?
No.
Yeah. Rosemary, let me just.
No, I really don't.
I don't either. No, look, I think they've got a working relationship, obviously. And I think she's a partner. And he is throwing her the big stuff. But I can't believe that she didn't want it.
I think that's immaterial. I don't think she can do it, is my point. I don't think she has the clout, experience, or heft to do it.
She was a United States senator. You know, she's been there. She knows what has to be done. She wanted the job, and I think she wanted to be president, as a matter of fact. And I think it's a great vote of confidence in this woman vice president. No kid gloves here.
But also, she's our first African-American vice president. She's our first African-American president or vice president. And, vice president, I should say, and female. And she's taking on this huge issue of voting rights, which so impacts black and brown people. So that makes sense in and of itself, does it not?
May I remind you, we had a black president who couldn't solve the problem of race in America. You're putting way too much weight on this woman, who, again, let me repeat, I have nothing but respect for. I think she will add immensely to the battle, but to put it all on her back is just asking for failure. But if you're going to put it on one black woman's back, why not Stacey Abrams?
Well,
Stacey Abrams is not the vice president. Yeah. Right.
And I hope she keeps on writing mystery novels, because I just finished hers and it's really good.
Stacey Abrams?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Okay. Chris Churchill, go ahead.
Well, I'm probably going to take a little bit of an unpopular position here and just to suggest that I think a lot of the language that is being used about elections is overwrought from kind of both political parties. I mean, already this morning we've heard words like fascism, apartheid, death of democracy. And I think if you actually look closely at the laws that are under consideration in some of these states, they're not nearly as dramatic as people are suggesting they are. And, you know, in some cases, New York's voting laws are more restrictive than the laws that these states are seeking to put into place. I somewhat understand the overwrought reaction given the claims about a stolen election and you know, the fact that a lot of these laws are attempting to respond to a GOP base that is convinced that the election was stolen. Yeah. But for the most part, the impact on actual voting, I don't think, is going to be significant. I mean, depending, you know, different states have different laws. I don't want to paint with a broad brush. But I do think that the rhetoric on both sides about elections has gotten dangerous. I don't think these laws are going to put apartheid or fascism or are going to kill democracy.
Don't you think, though, Chris, that these laws are purposely designed to make it more difficult for people, particularly people of color, to vote? That this is being put in place specifically in response to the loss of the election and the big lie?
I do think so. And I think that's why I do understand the reaction. But I think if you actually look at the language of the bills, I mean, you know, the Georgia law would have left in place more early voting than New York has.
Yeah.
Right.
New
you know,
York,
I think we need to look at our own laws as well as, you know, just because the state is a blue state doesn't mean that it's New York has long had some of the most restrictive voting laws in the country.
Yeah.
You know, there are elements of the Texas law that are certainly objectionable, the Sunday morning voting part of it in particular, which I think.
Why don't you explain that? Because I'm really offended by that one.
I mean, there's been some debate about whether this is actually in the final bill or not. But apparently, in some versions of the bill, it would restrict early voting on Sunday mornings, which seems like a pretty direct attempt to kill the souls to the polls. Is that what they call it?
Right.
You know, you go to
church,
vote after,
you pray, and then you go vote.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Which in a deeply religious state like Texas is kind of ironic. But, you know, a lot of the other measures are not really that dramatic. You know, a lot of them just kind of put into place relatively common sense things. And in some instances, they actually expand early voting a little bit. So I think there's more nuance to this than people are voicing.
We have about 30 seconds. So go ahead.
Okay, the question I wanted to ask Chris is, do you think Trump is a potential fascist?
I mean, yeah.
Yes,
I mean,
no.
It's hard to argue against that after what we saw on January 6th. I mean, I think he literally would have stolen the election if he'd been given the chance. You know, in one respect, though, you know, there's a kind of a push to federalize elections. And I think in some senses that might be a mistake because, you know, if Trump had the election power under his fingers, I think, you know, we would have been closer to a stolen election than we actually got with all the states doing it on their own.
Bob, I will say that you said there's one thing I do want to bring up. What was that?
Yeah, the comment that you made about Trump talking about coming back in August concerns me because of a couple issues. One is that it keeps his base fired up with this idea that the big lie is the truth. But over the weekend, Flynn, you know, General Flynn, who was the disgraced national security advisor, came out and basically endorsed a military coup, and you start to put these pieces together, and I do worry about what folks who are listening to Trump are thinking about. So it's just there's a couple of points that are out right now that are worrying me about potential violence and obviously the strength of our democracy.
We got a letter from a listener taking me to task for saying that Trump said that when he did not say it. It was conjecture. But in looking it up, Maggie Haberman is reporting that he has been telling people and has said, quote, that he expects that he will get reinstated by August.
I have at least one relative who is convinced that in 6 weeks, it may be 5 weeks now, that
rapture.
The date is very important. That the Supreme Court is going to vote 9-0 to overturn the election and reinstall
Trump. Oh my gosh!
Yeah. Smart person too. I mean, a professional. The lack of civics knowledge is, I think, a problem in this country because I don't know what the mechanism is for how this gets to the Supreme Court so quickly. And, you know.
There's a relative of yours, Chris?
Yeah. I won't name the person.
It was great how you answered that. Is this a relative of yours, Chris?
Yeah. Mother-in-law?
No, but it's disturbing. And I have spent many, many frustrating hours trying to convince this person that it's all a bunch of hooey, and there's just no, it's, you know, I haven't succeeded, let's put it that way.
It's ingrained.
Rosemary?
Yeah, I wanted to know why you leapt to the possible conclusion that it had to be Chris's mother-in-law.
You know, you're absolutely right. I do apologize abjectly, and number one, and number two, I want to say it was probably his father-in-law.
it was neither, although they may believe similar things.
Yeah,
my wife is going to kill me.
Can we have a
going back on that program?
We have a ton of letters, and I love looking just at the subject lines because it's like, really, Chris? And thanks, Chris. Rosemary, seriously? And just things like that. You haven't been named yet, Bob.
You're
but
not controversial
we'll get
enough,
to
Bob.
It.
Because they're confused about his name.
That's right. All right. So we get this. Voting law changes from Nancy. I completely disagree with Chris that some of the voting law changes are less restrictive than the existing laws in place like New York and Connecticut. What worries me about the laws, though, is that most of them contain a provision that allows local election results to be overturned by either the legislature or a state official. That provision is what we should worry about. Well,
and not only that, taking some of the power away from the state officials who were ruling about the continuity of elections and everything else, and those people are being thrown out of the loop. So it's not only the new ones who are coming in, it's the ones who are doing the right thing who are being thrown out.
Well, I mean, that may be true in some cases, but I will point out that the Georgia Secretary of State, whose name is escaping me right now, the one who was, who was quite heroic during last November, was defending the Georgia law. So, you know, if he feels that it's undermining him, he didn't say so publicly.
Well, you never know, do you, Chris? I mean, you never know whether somebody says, okay, I've taken these anti-Trump stances. He was a hero, no question about it, and I'm getting creamed, as we used to say, riding the waves. I'm sorry, Rosemary, on Fire Island. So it may well be, you never know, that he decided enough courage for a while.
We got this letter from John, who said, thank you, Chris Churchill. I deeply appreciate that Chris has the intellectual honesty to point out how states like New York limit access to voting and political inclusion. Please, let's start telling the truth about bipartisan attempts to limit participation and real, quote unquote, democracy. Followed that up by, really, Chris?
Wait. That's a very interesting issue, because I've long said that when the Democrats who were in the legislature, they got there under the old rules, not new rules, not reformist rules. So there's no question that what the writer is suggesting may be true, because it's been a loaded system for a long time, and it took Democrats and Republicans to make it that way.
Yeah, the people who are in power pass laws that entrench their power. I mean, that's
absolutely
kind of, both parties do it, and it's obviously unfortunate.
Absolutely right.
There's another point, though, back to an earlier letter. The other part of the law that really worries me is that the standard that can overturn an election is a preponderance of evidence, which means that basically if somebody feels like it was that something was wrong, which I think most people who lose an election feel like there was something is wrong, could use that as a standard to overturn the election. So there's a lot of bad language in some of these bills. With that said, I do agree with both the letter writer and you, Chris, that, you know, New York needs to look at itself. This is a hard place to really vote, and we should be leading the country in making it easier for people to vote.
Mm-hmm. Another Bob writes and says, some southern states may have expanded early voting by a few days, but the minor improvement is dwarfed by the new restrictions, such as banning 24-hour voting, which was used heavily by 9-to-5 workers, and requiring drop boxes to be in government buildings and manned whenever they are open. And let's not forget limiting polling places in minority areas and disallowing outside groups to financially support nonpartisan voting. It's a witch's brew of voter suppression.
There are two things, though, about how lopsided these laws tend to be. I think that writer is right, that, yes, New York has some terribly restrictive laws, but it restricts everything. The new laws we're seeing are aimed directly at minority voters, and that means before they're going to be reinforced or before they're installed, made practicable, there are going to be challenges. This is going to wind up in courts, in the whole federal system, and end up in the Supreme Court. So I think that we're actually years away from actually seeing them try to be enforced. And secondly, it's going to annoy and anger and rekindle the civil rights movement. We're back to the 1960s with this.
Well,
there'll be a reaction.
To that point, didn't we see that in reaction
Georgia.
To the, well, in Georgia, but across the country in reaction to the United States Postal Service and the actions that were being taken of the boxes being removed and showing the mail sorters out in the parking lot and that kind of thing, where people said, okay, well, no, we're still going to vote. We're going to get out. That it does work to the other side.
The problem is that none of that is permanent. None of the actions that have been taken on voting or other things too, like leases in the Arctic, are permanent. And just as Biden came in and undid everything Trump did, the next guy, if it's not, God forbid it's Trump, but if it's a Republican, we'll undo it and we'll be right back where we were. What this country requires...
The next woman that comes in.
Next woman, that'd be even better. But what this country requires, what it's built on through the Constitution, is that laws are permanent and they're made by Congress. And Congress has abdicated that.
Yeah, there's another element here too, Joe, that I'd like to toss into the pile. And it's not just race, it's also class. If you start to think about people who are, you know, who, you're working a job that you can't take time off, you don't have all day to stand in line to
right.
vote, you have to work, you don't get off until after the polls close. I mean, that class plays a role in this as well, and I think we need to be very careful about the seeds of class distrust that a lot of these bills also raise.
But you know, to Chris's point too, and I live in a rural area, but you know, here in New York, you have early voting. But I got to go to the county center to do it, and that's 35 miles away. So how many people are going to be able to do that when they can, or even to have the gas money to get up there and back? So there's a lot of problems there. We have many more letters. I'll get to a couple here. Real quick, Biden has given Harris some jobs well known to be intractable. This is trial by fire, not to make her fail, but to let the American people see how well she deals with failure. Teresa says the blatant attacks on voting rights by the GOP are sickening. Thanks, Robert. What tangible actions do you think those of us in New York can do to fight against this? By the way, I totally agree with Rosemary regarding Vice President Harris.
I mean, there's a couple things. Letters, emails to our congressional delegation, to all of our congressional delegation, certainly helps. I think at the local level, where change really begins, that we should be working as communities to make it easier for people to vote. And again, as I said a little bit earlier, that New York should become the model for modern voting, not the system that we have right now. And it begins at the local level.
And, you know, when I'm asked about, Bob, about how people can make a difference, I always talk about letters to the paper, for example, letters to the newspaper, which can be extraordinarily impressive to a legislator who is trying to hold on to their seat. His or her, and so they see this letter, and I've seen them cut them out in my day hanging around the legislature and say, get me one of these.
Yeah, Alan, the squeaky wheel gets the grease, and in response to the question from the letter writer, you have to stay squeaky.
Bob Griffin on the Roundtable panel on Wednesday, June 2nd. Please note as you listen, any given topics, details, and facts may have changed or evolved since the panels took place live earlier in the week. We'll be back with more Roundtable Panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuc. For Thursday, June 3rd's Roundtable Panel, Alan Chartok and Joe Donahue welcomed Albany City Chief Auditor, Dorcia Pleers, Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Acarius-Kelly, and Publisher Emeritus of the Daily Freeman, Ira Fussfeld.
The fragile coalition to oust Netanyahu faces growing pressure. Benjamin Netanyahu, the longest-serving prime minister in Israeli history, was close to being knocked out of power for the first time in 12 years. And that was, when I went to bed, was the headline I was dealing with. But now, Mr. Netanyahu has signaled that he would not go down without a struggle. The agreement to replace Netanyahu with Naftali Bennett is still up in the air. That vote, I believe, still expected to happen between 7 and 12 days from now. And again, I think the word, which even was used when it was when it seemed to be a bit more apparent, was the word fragile, a fragile coalition. So, Alan, your thoughts?
Well, it has to be fragile. And the moment that the moment that Netanyahu disappears from the scene, you're going to see verbal combat, over there. And of course, there is this relationship between Trump and Netanyahu. They are, in my mind, the same guy, probably separated at birth. And, I'm fascinated by the fact that in a not so subtle way, Netanyahu is calling on all of those people who have to go along with this, who are in those coalition partners, to reject the deal and basically signaling that he's going to go after individuals in each of those places who, like American politicians, aren't going to want to lose their meal ticket.
Vera.
Well, I think it's going to be fascinating because this is parliamentary politics 101 here that we're going to watch. Because, first of all, the Knesset has to vote this new coalition into parliament and affirm the ultra-nationalist Naftali Bennett in this coalition. But what's interesting is that the speaker is a member of the Likud party, a member, a supporter of Netanyahu, and he will try and expand the time period when this vote actually happens by as long as almost 2 weeks. So now Netanyahu, who's an incredibly talented, rough and tumble politician, will try to come up with any option and angle to blow this eight-party coalition apart. It won't be that difficult in a sense because those parties are so broad a coalition and they have no overlap on the Israeli-Arab-Palestinian negotiation process. What they have agreed to is only talk about infrastructure and economic policy, but nothing that is highly controversial so far. And that's the angle that Netanyahu and his party will use to try and bombard this coalition and blow it apart and try to pursue some kind of opportunity to reassemble a coalition himself. Now, the problem with him is that he has not been loyal to his own former, coalition partners and has always preferred to save himself and strengthen his own power position. So this is going to be a super interesting Game of Thrones we're seeing here.
Okay, so our Red Wedding aside, are you thinking that if you had to prognosticate, what do you think is going to come of this?
There's a 50-50 chance here that I see for Netanyahu to remain. If he successfully goes after either the hard right or the hard left by creating a rift between the two extremes that are now in this coalition, if he manages to split off some of them, then the eight-party coalition isn't strong enough.
Well, it seems to me that Alan had a point about Netanyahu's relationship with Trump. I think he Netanyahu has gone to school on Trump, and rhetorically and perhaps in action is going to it's going to all seem very familiar what's going to happen there as opposed to what's happened here. I wish I could tell you I know this very well, but I what I thought I read was that the would-be prime minister is farther to the right than is Netanyahu.
Well, by far.
By
yes.
far.
By
and
far.
That, and that mm-hmm. makes me wonder Well, why? And because it's also my impression that one of the reasons that Netanyahu's position had become tenuous is that he was losing the support of his people, who wanted him to become more moderate, particularly the younger people wanted him to become more moderate. So I'm not sure how the coalition, I think you use the word fragile. If not, I'll use it. I just don't know how it can stay together with the kind of diversity in political philosophy that exists there.
So the whole, what they all agree on is they want to get rid of Netanyahu, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's the key.
That's the
only thing they got.
Because Netanyahu is accused of having committed a series of corruption-related and bribery-related crimes. So he's, you know, defended, the famous defendant number one in court, and they are simply all tired of his power-grabbing conduct. And so they're using all kinds of mechanisms to now push him out of politics so he can finally face the indictments from 2019.
We asked this question earlier in the week, and I'll ask it of you. How much do you think the violence of the last 2 weeks has played into this coalition?
Well, what's interesting is that a lot of people made the assumption that the violence actually benefited Netanyahu because he could unite the Israeli voting public, you know, behind him and position himself as the defender of the homeland against the attack from Hamas. However, what has happened is that this was an opportunity that also created an opening to other parties on the left and right to say, we have had Netanyahu for 12 years. Isn't it time to try a different ticket? Because things are getting worse. Nothing is resolved. We need to have more of a coalition arrangement to represent all of Israel or the majority of Israelis, rather than every 6 to 8 months have a new election that doesn't resolve in a satisfactory outcome. So it actually has weakened Netanyahu, despite the fact that people assumed it might be the opposite. So what we see now is an effort to bring a unified coalition front forward in Israel. And, Bennett will be, if he is confirmed, only be prime minister for 2 years. The next prime minister that's in the deal is the secular, more moderate Israeli coalition. So they already worked out double prime ministerships.
Alan?
If they get that far, as you may remember, the last time around, Netanyahu promised power sharing also, and we never quite got there. And really, it is so unlikely that these people won't start to fight with each other that it's hard to believe it's going to be anything like a long-term arrangement.
Yeah, king for a day. Dorsey,
exactly.
Your thoughts?
So, you know, my thoughts are similar to what has already been said. So I'll just reinforce a few points. You know, we can't forget the backdrop here. We, across the world, just witnessed a lot of bloodshed, people on the ground devastated by the fighting that was happening. And so that's the backdrop. And this situation, although multi-layered, it reminds me of this quote that I love, and it's, through chaos, there is opportunity. And as was already mentioned, this coalition, in the midst of all of this chaos, between the bloodshed, the corruption, sees this moment of opportunity. And I think some are putting the cart before the horse, talking about the coalition and the dysfunction that people project because their views are so vastly different. But this coalition, going back to why it was formed in the first place, their primary function in this moment in time is to get Netanyahu out of his leadership position. And they seem to be working that angle very well at this moment and are positioned to accomplish that goal. The last point that I'll make in Alan mentioned this and some and other panelists. You know, if you look at the dynamics that played out in the U.S. election and what's happening now, there are some similarities here. And I want to be very sensitive to point out that not identical, but chaos, which led to opportunity for a change in administration, but also the figurehead. If you look at Trump and what people have said about him, those who really wanted him out of office, you look at the Netanyahu and what people have said about him and why they want him out of office, very similar. Leadership that believes they put themselves over the people. There are some serious character flaws and character issues. They're very volatile. They have burned various bridges when it comes to their allies. And so this notion of loyalty, they just don't get that. They don't understand it. They don't operate from that. And then lastly, you know, two figures who are motivated by power and are reckless with yielding that power. And so I think, you know, while, you know, of course he will be fighting tooth and nail to maintain that power, his track record has shown people who he will attempt to bring back in his corner that it's smoke and mirrors. No matter what he says, he will do what he wants to do, and he does not recognize this notion of playing fair and being loyal to allies.
This from Bill. Yesterday morning, I had the radio on but was doing something else, and I was only half listening when I thought I heard the news reporter say that Tony Bennett is going to be the new prime minister of Israel. No.
He left his heart in San Francisco.
Different Bennett.
If, in fact, the coalition becomes more tenuous than the optimists would like it to be, does that not put Israel, the state, in more jeopardy from its neighbors? In other words, if the neighbors who are out to get Israel sense and can see real strife within Israel, will they feel this is the good time to pounce?
On the other hand, Ira, my bet is that one of the reasons that the Israeli Arab Party is joining the coalition is everybody wants to see Netanyahu out of there.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, it's true. I mean, I don't give any hope at all to this thing lasting for any great amount of time, but I do think everybody stands to gain who wants Netanyahu out of there.
And this was another question that I had that we had raised earlier in the week in discussing this, which is the idea this coalition came together instead of holding yet another election,
right?
You know, another fourth election. So even if this coalition stands, how long before that rears its head again, do you think?
I think the whole question is, how does the country move away from the current state of polarization and come up with some kind of a broader umbrella agreement? And that is what this coalition is trying to do, to focus not on the Arab-Israeli situation for now, but come up with a broader coalition on infrastructure and economic reform. And if they can do it, if they can shift the country away from the Arab-Israeli-Palestinian larger regional question and do something else for a while, they can build a larger coalition that then definitely excludes Netanyahu, and the next election might bring a broader consensus around modernization and infrastructure issues and economic issues that then strengthens the country to actually go back to an Israeli-Palestinian conversation. But right now, what we have is no focus on that. Instead, it is an emphasis on broadening, you know, consensus in the country that doesn't end with a fifth election that basically splits the country's population in half in this election. So it's an attempt to overcome the current blockage and polarization with a new approach, which was really needed, something new. I'm not sure it will work, but it's worth a shot, I think.
Vera Icarius-Kelly on the Roundtable panel on Thursday, June 3rd. We'll be back with more Roundtable panel The Week in Review after this. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. On Friday's show, Joe Donahue and Alan Chartok welcomed former EPA Regional Administrator, Visiting Professor at Bennington College, and President of Beyond Plastics, Judith Enck, Siena College Professor of Economics, Aaron Pasitti, and Albany County District Attorney, David Soares.
As I mentioned, we wanted to address the issue of infrastructure and are we close to a deal? President Biden narrowing infrastructure request, but hurdles remain for a bipartisan deal. The president offered new concessions this week, including dropping his plan to reverse some of the 2017 tax cuts as he tries to win support from Senate Republicans. A deal still appears to be a long shot, with potential tax increases the biggest hurdle to winning the kind of Republican support that Mr. Biden has said he is seeking. But the continued movement underscored his hopes for a revival of bipartisanship. The talks are being sustained by a desire among lawmakers in both parties to reach agreement over what has been a longstanding but elusive goal in Congress, repairing and enhancing the country's network of roads, bridges, water pipes, and other physical infrastructure. Both sides are trying to win favor with the moderate congressional Democrats, particularly in the Senate, who will ultimately decide the fate of the president's $4 trillion economic agenda. So, with that word economic, we'll go to Aaron. But before we do, Alan, your thoughts.
Well, no, you know, we know who they are. They come from the land of no. They're scared to death of for want of a better term, of the past president, Trump. No matter what Biden puts on the table to get their acquiescence so that we can have a sensible rule here, they say no. And they're going to keep saying no. He lowers it. They say not enough. They just are not going to go along with this. It's political. It's not nearly economical as many of us would hope. So that's what it's all about, and they will keep doing what they're doing, period.
This is absolutely political. It is not economic because what they're talking about—
Don't tell Aaron that.
Well, you know, I'm trying to say. Yeah, I'm trying to take some time here so he can get in his glasses on and put on his material, because we're talking about job numbers today, right?
Yeah, he'll have his moment, yeah. But go ahead.
The Republicans cannot do anything that will be interpreted as a victory for the Democratic Party, and that's what this is about. And so the only two people that don't know this on planet Earth is Kristen Sinema and my man Joe from West Virginia.
Yeah. For the past 25 years, Republicans have not been interested in bipartisan compromise on anything.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, Biden could have a $200 billion infrastructure plan, something that's, you know, a tenth of the original size, and Republicans would be opposed to it for some other different set of reasons, whether it's the tax increases to help fund it, whether it's the scale of the spending, whether it's the scope of what it attempts to solve. I think Biden is barking up the wrong tree in trying to reach some type of compromise with Republicans. They're just not going to compromise on anything, period, because the goal is to get Biden out and get a Republican back in the White House. I think there's a larger issue at play here, and that is the modern Republican Party has built itself on the basis that government is inefficient. Anything the government does is just going to make things worse. I think what they're facing is, well, the country needs a reboot of its infrastructure to the tune of $4 trillion. And they're scared to see that the government might actually do something that benefits the population and is actually effective. And I think Biden has a lot of leverage in terms of his two big moonshot bills, the infrastructure bill and the American Families Plan, of saying, look, the government can make people's lives a little bit easier. They can make our infrastructure represent that of the wealthiest country in the history of humanity.
Yes, but doesn't Biden to some degree make out here? And the reason I say that is people aren't stupid. They're going to see who's objecting to this. They know what their needs are. It's why the Republicans are going hum now, because they know they're between a rock and a hard place. So even if he doesn't get what he wants, which he should, there will be some political benefits to the Democrats.
I don't know about that.
I'm not placing my faith in the intelligence of the masses anymore, not after this past year and the pandemic. The reality is the world is the world. Your world is dependent upon the media ecology that you subscribe to. And there's just a lot of people out there who continue to be influenced by misinformation. That's too much of a gamble for the president of the United States to gamble on. And I'm just wondering when it gets to the point where Joe Manchin comes to the White House and President Biden says, look, I'm going to offer you a cabinet level position. So, you know, if you lose your election, you know, you will be okay. And the same for Kristen Sinema, who doesn't obviously understand history as well and continues to take this defiant, you know, position that we can achieve bipartisanship when there's been no evidence to suggest that it is possible under this climate.
Well, I think that that's an interesting concept, David. But I think Manchin really believes that you have to gut the most important provisions of crucial bills in order to be able to call it bipartisan. And I think that the Biden administration is making a very important strategic mistake here. Biden is very high in the polls. I think people are grateful that American politics is not a psychodrama every day, and that the Biden administration is competent, as we see with the vaccine rollout. He established a deadline. He said, and people thought Memorial Day was too generous, but he said, if there's no deal by Memorial Day, he's going to go his own way. That's a song. there was no deal by Memorial Day. And I think it's fairly obvious what Biden can do. He has the power of the presidency. Early on, he said there were four cabinet members that were going to go out and sell the stimulus package to the American public. A lot of these projects are what they're called shovel ready. So, you know, there's a bridge that's collapsing. There's a subway line in New York City that breaks down constantly. A tunnel needs to be built. A drinking water system needs to be upgraded. A sewage treatment plant is sending raw sewage into the Hudson River every time it rains. I'm not making that up. That happens all the time when it rains with the Hudson River. So it's really not that hard. You make your list of projects that are going to get funded, and you go congressional district by congressional district, and you go and sell it. You have to be aggressive. You cannot be passive. And Memorial Day has passed. So let's get out there and explain to people the benefit. You know, you hear infrastructure package and your eyes glaze over. You know, not everyone is hanging on every last paragraph in Politico, but you go out and you say, you know, the bridge you go over every day is ranked F by structural engineers. Might it be a good idea to fix it? I think you have to go out and sell it. And I hope that's what we're going to see now from the Biden administration. Otherwise, you know, nothing is going to pass.
Yeah, I mean, so I think Judith identified just the critical public safety, public health, economic justice aspect of infrastructure. Now, all of a sudden, Republicans are interested in infrastructure. Well, they had 4 years, you know, it was 4 years of infrastructure week. That just blew by, and all they passed was a $1.5 trillion tax cut. So to think that Republicans are actually interested in improving the country's infrastructure, I think, is a laughable concept, because they had 4 years to do anything, and they did nothing.
There's plenty of examples that support exactly what Judith is talking about, and for whatever reason, we're choosing not to focus on them. I mean, it wasn't that long ago that we saw children in Detroit, you know, being poisoned by the very water that they were drinking. It wasn't that long ago that we just experienced a power outage in Texas, of all places, that you know, people died because they froze in their homes. And so this issue of infrastructure, it isn't an abstract issue. We're experiencing it every single day in different parts of the country. And I do think that the Democrats are negotiating against themselves. Why would you be, you know, reducing the tax rate on corporations and conveying that as an offer to the Republicans when they have no intentions of acting on any of those things?
Philip writes, the American public is not smart. How can you watch Trump supporters and say the public is smart? Please stop the Pollyanna nonsense.
I don't think they're not smart. I just think they have a different set of values that conflicts with what many other people believe.
I think that could be a bumper sticker. Please stop the Pollyanna nonsense.
I think it's one of the few times we've been accused of being Pollyanna-ish. Yeah, usually that, you know, we're the sky is falling. But okay. David says the GOP cannot let Biden make people happier. It would destroy two of their myths by proving government can fix problems and create jobs at the same time. Speaking of jobs, Aaron.
Yeah, this is the first Friday of every month is something I look forward to, not because it's Friday, but that's when the Bureau of Labor Statistics releases its monthly employment report. So the unemployment rate dropped from 6.1% to 5.8%. The U.S. economy added 559,000 jobs in May, which is double what it added in April. So it was a good report. It was a little shy of expectations. Good, but not great. We still have over 9 million unemployed workers. And at the current rate of job creation, so if we add 500,000 jobs a month, it won't be until November 2022 that we get back to where we were before the pandemic started. So there's still going to be a very long and very bumpy road in terms of getting the labor market, creating jobs back to where it was in February 2020. Most of the job gains came in leisure and hospitality. That was about half of all of the job gains. Obviously, the sector that lost the most jobs when the pandemic started is experiencing the fastest rebound. There's still 3 million workers that are just out of the labor force. You know, they had a job, and they're not even looking for work anymore. They're not classified as unemployed because they're not actively searching for work. So, you know, we've got 12 million people who presumably want to work, but just for a variety of reasons aren't working.
You cannot walk past the store in Great Barrington that doesn't have a help wanted sign in it. And I know you've addressed this before, but, you know, everybody poo-poos the unemployment question. But it seems to me there may be something there.
There is. A $20 trillion economy with, a labor force of, you know, over 150 million workers can't just reboot a year's worth of lost economic activity in a couple months. That's going to take time. There's going to be a lot of frictions associated with it. So a lot of jobs are going to go unfilled. And the reason why you see a lot of unfilled jobs has to do with, like I said, a variety of factors. Workers who don't have access to affordable child care. Workers who have health concerns. Workers who are gaming the unemployment insurance system and are willing to not take jobs because they're getting as much or nearly as much as they would from unemployment insurance. And then there's another group of workers that perhaps want to work remotely, but but can't find remote work options. And then I think there's another category that I really want this to be true, that maybe some workers are recalibrating their priorities. Perhaps the pandemic has made it so that some families say, well, you know, we had two incomes before this started, and we can really get by on one income, so, you know, a second member of the household doesn't have to work. Maybe workers are becoming choosier in the types of jobs they accept and just aren't willing to take, you know, a $15 an hour job with no benefits. So there's going to be bumps. There's going to be like I said, frictions, and this is probably going to persist for a long time, and it's going to be bumpy and it's going to be ugly, but, you know, that's what happens when you try to lift an economy out of a years-long coma.
Well, what should Biden do? Should he say, come on, folks, you know, or should he deal with the unemployment, you know, benefits in order to get people to go back to work?
Can I just say something here that I don't want to seem Pollyannish here, but
no.
And this is the first time on record in 51 years I've ever used the word Pollyannish. I may lose all my street credibility now for using that word. But, you know, I think we just have to take a real deep breath here and not read too much into these indicators that we've seen over the course of the last 2 months. Because if you're looking at this and if you're looking at these numbers and you're just conducting your normal analysis, there's an assumption that all other parts of our economy and our society are functioning well. And I only look to my own example in my workplace, and I think of all of the parents that have lost, you know, childcare at and they're still working on trying to build, you know, that support infrastructure for their own families. I look at the number of people who, you know, I work with that have experienced health, you know, issues that quite frankly were not there before, that are delaying their return. And so I anticipate that all of these things in the course of the next 6 months will sort of stabilize, because this idea that now we have vaccines and, boy, we've got a lot of people that are vaccinated and we can open up, we can have dinner. There's not a snap of the finger that's going to, you know, make our economy just return to what it was in 2019.
That's absolutely right. And let's remember, 600,000 Americans died from COVID. Many are sick. And while vaccine is going in the right direction, we have about 12 states that are at about 70% vaccination rate. But on average for the whole country, we're still just under half of the eligible people for vaccines actually have it.
So, when do we get the beer?
Yeah, I think in July.
July 4th, if we hit 70%, right? Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, there's the perception that things are back to normal, but for a lot of people, it's not. And school is just letting out this month. There's still so many heroic teachers and frazzled parents who are still doing Zoom school for another week or two. And, you know, there are health consequences to right. what the world is still going through. And, you know, if you want to look globally, there are still many, many countries that have very, very low vaccine rates. So, this is typically American, where there's the expectation that, okay, you know, my family and I are vaccinated, so the economy is going to bounce back within 2 weeks. And I think Aaron points out wisely that this is all going to take some time. I mean, this was a seismic jolt to our economy and our whole society over the last year and a half.
Judah Thank on the Roundtable panel on Friday, June 4th. Full episodes of the Roundtable panel are available online at wamc.org/roundtable or via podcast. This has been this week's Roundtable panel, The Week in Review. I'm Sarah LaDuke. Thank you for listening.